So I've got something exciting to share. My book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is now available for pre-order. It's about rethinking your drinking, not because you necessarily have to, but because deep down you know there's more waiting on the other side. It's about creating space for clarity, for calm, and the version of you that doesn't need alcohol to cope. So if you're looking for a refreshing take on alcohol identity and desire, just tap the link in the show notes and pre-order. Right, let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. Why, hello, and welcome back to the Big Drink Rethink, where today I am thrilled to be joined in the studio by Amber Hollingsworth. So in recent episodes, I've been talking quite a lot about connection, about disconnection, and then reconnection. And of course, the fact that alcohol doesn't just distance us from ourselves and our emotions, but can actually very, very painfully disconnect us from the people we love as well. So I'm thrilled to have Amber here. She is a counsellor. She is a family recovery expert. She's got a huge number of years helping people untangle the complicated dynamics that alcohol creates in households. And what I love is that her work isn't just obviously about the individual drinker, therefore, it's about the whole system. It's about the parents, it's about the partners, the siblings, the children, anyone who gets pulled into, you know, let's call it alcohol's orbit, really. So I've read a lot about Amber's compassionate and sort of very practical approach. I'm excited that she's here to talk about it as well, especially her take on boundaries, actually, which I know we're going to get into as well. So it makes her the perfect guest for this theme. And welcome to the show, Amber.
Hey, thanks for having me here, Anna. I'm excited.
No, it's great. And I love your accent as well.
Same. Same.
Oh, that's a mutual love in on the accents. Before we leap into the dynamics and, you know, the core conversation, I'd love listeners to understand and learn a little bit more about you. Because if they don't know you already, which they well might, because as I said, you've done a lot of work in this area. Mm-hmm. If they don't know you already, if you could perhaps share a little bit about your story and what you do now and I guess how you've come to really focus on families and not just the individual drinker.
Sure. Well, I've been working in this field, helping people who have addictions for more than 20 years now. And almost all of my clients, not all of them, but most of the people that have come to see me over the years have come in with quite a bit of reluctance. They either didn't think they had a problem at all, or even if they thought they had a problem, didn't want to be seeing me, and usually were leveraged in somehow, some way externally. And so over all of those years, I've developed a skill set as far as how do you engage someone who's not super excited about sitting in your office? And the family piece comes in that in my experience dealing with people who are reluctant coming in, almost always the only thing that you can get them to talk about is their frustration with their family. Usually one primary family member. It's usually the person closest to them, like their parent or their spouse or someone living with them. And they're so resentful and frustrated at this primary person who they feel like is trying to control them and being critical of them and being negative towards them and doesn't understand them. It's all they'll talk about. And eventually I realized I'm not going to get anywhere helping anyone if I don't get these family members to get out of this bad guy role. And they get sort of sucked into this villain bad guy role, not on purpose, on accident. And it's unfortunate because from their point of view, they're trying to help. They're usually taking care of someone else's responsibilities. And, you know, the thanks they get for that is a lot of anger and resentment towards them. And so that's where the family piece came in, is because it's really essential, because as long as the family member is playing the villain, I can't get anywhere with my person. And so step number one is to get the family member out of that role.
Yeah, no, that makes a huge amount of sense. And just to be clear then, is it very often the family member who's coming to you and saying, can you help my husband? Can you help my partner? Can you help my wife or my son or my daughter? To which normally the standard response is yes, if they want help. Or is it normally the other case? Are you often sort of confronted by someone who's coming to see you and saying, I know I have a problem, but this person, my wife, my partner, et cetera, they're at the root of it.
Most of the time, the initial person reaching out is the family member. And I like what you said, Anna. It's like, you know, can you help my loved one? And then the standard answer is yes, if they want help. That is a standard answer, but it's not the answer I give anymore. And it's, if your loved one doesn't want help or think they have a problem, then I can teach you how to get them to want help and think they have a problem.
Oh,
and that's a lot of what we do on our YouTube channel, is coach families through that process. We have something called the invisible intervention. It's called that because it's not like the kind you see on TV, like the person never even knows it happened. That's why it's invisible. And so even if you have a loved one who's in denial, who doesn't think they have a problem, or maybe they think they have a problem, but they want to do it on their own, or they don't think they need help, there's a lot that you can do to influence that situation. And I basically teach families all the skills I've used over the years of how do you engage someone who's reluctant about it. And there are actually a lot of things you can do.
Yeah. So you might even be working with families in the absence of the drinker.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. I don't think I quite appreciated that. That's interesting. So you really are. You've got someone who is drinking too much, whether or not they've got a problem or not, mm-hmm. sort of by they're drinking too much.
Right.
It's creating negativity in that unit, whatever that unit comprises.
Right.
They feel like an intervention is needed.
Yes.
That particular person's not coming to the table, not taking their place at the table, but you can still work with everybody else to say, here's how you can create the right sort of atmosphere and emotional environment for change. Yeah,
absolutely. In fact, these days I want the family to have done that work before I ever see that person. Not that I can see the person and I can get them there, but it's going to take me 6 months or a year, and that's just a lot of money to be paying. Whereas if the family will just do these few things that I'm teaching them up front first, then when I do see the person, I'm going to hit the ground running. And so it expedites the process, it saves a lot of money, and it makes it where the process sticks. Mm-hmm. So I prefer to have the family involved first to set the right stage.
Amazing. Okay, so you know, you've got someone wanting to engage with you to ask for your help, your input, your guidance on how they deal with a family member or a loved one. What typically are they describing as the problems that drinking is causing within the family or within the household?
Well, a lot of the people that reach out to us and that we deal with these days are what people might call like a high functioning alcoholic. Mm-hmm. They're usually still working, a lot of them very successful. We see a lot of business people, a lot of lawyers, a lot of physicians, and they are very successful. And it's really hard to get someone that's functioning so well and sometimes, you know, making a lot of money on top of their career to believe or think they have any kind of alcohol problem that they need to address it. And so that's usually what they're saying to me is, hey, you know, I'm married to this person. They're lovely. They're wonderful. But, you know, they may be a rock star at work, but at home, it's not good. You know, they're drinking from the time they leave work. They're either, you know, kind of like going to sleep, or they're distant, or maybe they're obnoxious, or maybe they're, you know, causing trouble. And then they get this dynamic where they're trying to force the person to see the problem, and the more they try to force the person to see the problem, the more the person doesn't see the problem. What they see mm-hmm. is that I have a spouse problem, not an alcohol problem.
Yeah, I can relate to this I was very, very lucky because when I ran into my drinking problems, I was aware of them. I mean, I hid them. I hid my drinking for a long time. So I did that very well as well, by the way. I managed to hide quite a lot. So I knew I had a problem. Probably more, you know, but before my husband did. And he was then very, very supportive. I never made it a him problem. It was very much a me problem. I knew that. And he sort of leapt in and was, as you know, as supportive as you could ever ask somebody to be. But I speak a lot to people who, they kind of flip that script. It's that fact that I'm okay. I just wish that they would leave me alone. You know, stop making this into something more than it is. It's driving my issues, not solving my issues.
Right.
And that's what you mean, isn't it? By making them the bad one.
Right. And you bring up a really good point, Anna, about how you realized it and you knew it maybe before other people knew it. And to be truthful, that's actually the case almost all the time. But what happens is once the family picks up on it, if they start to engage in a power struggle about it, even though that this person deep down inside, they have their own reasons and motivations. They are things that they don't like about their drinking. They get fixated on defending themselves.
100%.
And then that, and the more you put someone in a position to defend what they're doing, the more they convince themselves. So it's almost like you're taking them, you know, you don't mean to, but you're accidentally taking them in the wrong direction. You're getting them to defend what they're doing, rationalize, minimize what they're doing, blame you, start being secretive about it, you know, and then you get this whole dynamic, which can go on for years and years and years, which slows down the process of people realizing it. When if you just give people the space, they'll come forward with it, just like what you're describing.
And that's actually, you're absolutely right. If you give people the space, they'll come forward eventually. Mm-hmm. But as you say, you know, when they feel cornered, up against the ropes, you know, boxing analogy, up against the ropes, all they're doing is, as you say, sort of defending and protecting. And you know, it's a lot of fear. It's a lot of fear mixed in with, you know, with the denial that the point is being pushed, isn't it?
Yes.
That the conversation is being driven and it's not being driven by them. And that's incredibly uncomfortable.
Exactly. And most people, they don't want to acknowledge it out loud to anyone else because they're not sure if they want to quit. And they're not sure what they want to do about it. And if they acknowledge it or say one little word about it, immediately people just sort of like jump on it. And they're not sure about that. So they don't say it and they keep it inside. And so, and not only that, but then they defend the other end of the angle when people are coming at them. And like I said, it really just drags the whole process out so much longer than it has to be.
Yeah. And I suppose as well, all of this is contextualized by, you know, an assumption that if it is surfaced, if it's accepted that I have a drinking challenge, then it's almost this sort of all or nothing.
Right.
I'm going to have to quit. And right. And also, you know, again, because we know that AA is the sort of, it's led and still leads the conversation around what it is to have a drinking problem and be an alcoholic, it comes with a lot of those assumptions of, you know, the all or nothing.
Yes.
That's also on the part of the family as well as the drinker.
You know, oh, yeah.
So yes, it suddenly becomes a sort of a fear laden, incredibly difficult conversation. And I suppose some of the other things that are likely going on, there's already going to be that sort of emotional tension in the family. Mm-hmm. Things that aren't being said but are simmering away and sort of festering away. Mm-hmm. Secrecy. You mentioned as well, never a great dynamic in a relationship. But then I guess you can have family members just walking around on eggshells. Mm-hmm. You know, you have very unpredictable, probably quite an emotionally unsafe family environment. You've got an environment that's possibly being witnessed by children as well, which throws in a whole new dynamic. So there's a lot going on, I guess, at the point when they come and engage you.
It's very complicated. And you mentioned secrecy, Anna, and it's not just secrecy on the part of the person who maybe is drinking. It's secrecy on both sides because you got this cat and mouse dynamic. So the one person is trying to secretly drink because their loved one is trying to monitor it all the time. And then the loved one is trying to secretly monitor it. And they're literally going through everything behind the scenes, and they're watching the bank accounts, and they're smell checking you, not really hugging you. There's secret keeping going on every which way. And the trust issue runs in both directions, not just one.
Yeah, no, goodness me, this is throwing me back actually to sort of conversations had literally on the, you know, on the cusp of me giving up. These were the moments when I knew I had to stop drinking. I knew I needed help, even if that was ending up going to be self-help. I needed to be able to do that openly. But, you know, I also know that, you know, my husband's a fixer. Mm-hmm. And I had this sort of sense that as soon as I put it out there that I had a problem, then it was no longer mine anymore. Mm-hmm. And with all the best well intention and, you know, all the best or goodwill in the world, you know, the sort of the drinking police would sort of show up.
Oh yeah.
You'd have to be watched.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
At least they have like a black light in their trunk that they pull out. I mean, they get serious. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's that in itself is obviously very damaging to sort of relationship dynamics as well. So there's a whole load of stuff going on there for sure. I can see that secrecy and sort of planning and scheming on both sides.
Definitely. Yeah. And let me tell you what, you're not going to out plan or scheme someone with an addiction issue happening. You're just not. Like they're going to win out.
Yeah, well, they've got all the they've got all the moves, haven't they? They've got well rehearsed moves. So, Amber, on one of, you know, over the last few weeks when we've been talking about connection and disconnection on this show, I mean, it's clearly right up there as one of the sort of highest order human needs that we have. We need to connect to other people emotionally, physically, mm-hmm. creating a space of, you know, safety and security. And when that gets broken, you know, bad things happen. So how, and if this isn't too broad a question, how has your work shaped your own understanding of the impact of both solid connection and also, you know, sad disconnection?
Well, early on, when I like to say when I was a baby counselor, when I was brand new out the gate, out of school, one of the first things I was tasked with was running this program for teenagers that had addictions. I'm telling you, there's really nothing harder than that. And I didn't know what I was doing.
Huge respect.
Oh, my gosh. Listen, I was so far over my head. But I didn't want anyone to know I didn't know what I was doing. So I was running this program, and so I decided, well, I just got to make these kids show up, because if they stop showing up, it's going to be pretty obvious I'm not doing a good job. And so I focused entirely on trying to make the program something that wasn't horrible, and that they would show up, because it was an outpatient program, and I had to get these teenagers to show up 3 times a week for 3 hours at a time.
Oh, wow.
That's no easy feat. Yeah. Okay.
No.
Like,
no.
You're not only competing with the fact they have addiction, but everything else they have in their lives. And I did that because I didn't know what else to do. And I was really just trying to pretend like I knew what I was doing. And so the crazy thing about it is it worked, because I was interested in them. And the way I made them want to come is I was just interested in them. I just listened to them and I liked them and they liked me back. And so they kept showing up. And they kept showing up so long they wanted to keep coming. And so to keep coming, they had to get sober. And I made this mentor program that if they got sober, they graduated, they could keep coming for free as long as they wanted to, as long as they weren't causing trouble and putting anybody else at risk, they could keep coming. And the whole thing worked, not because I had any secret super addiction power skills, but because they wanted to come. So they got sober to stay in the program. They wanted to be mentors and help other kids. The whole thing worked purely on the basis of connection. It was the only tactic going, and it worked, and it still works today.
And were they likely to sort of vocalize that? Were they sort of able to say, this is one of the only places where I come and I am seen and I am heard? this is the only place where I kind of get this level of interest? Do you actually care? Are you interested in me? Or was it more subtle than that?
I think it just depends on personality, you know, how self-reflective someone is, how open and vulnerable someone is. But behavior says more than words anyways. And so the fact that they would show up and they would keep coming back, you know, that speaks volumes. And the really cool thing is, anybody who's gone to any kind of like recovery group of any sort, it's kind of interesting because you get to hear people being really real with each other on a level that you don't get in regular life. And you connect on a deeper level than you connect. And so you realize like, no, they're having real conversations with real people here instead of like maybe superficial conversations that you might have with friends or whatever. And so that level of connecting with each other is just on a deeper level, and you keep coming back. It's almost like you don't want to miss coming because it's like missing the next episode of your favorite Netflix show. It's like, no, I got to find out what happened. You know, did they tell their mom? Did this happen? Did that happen?
Yeah.
You're all invested. Yeah.
That makes so much sense. So when you're working with people and you're working with, say, a family unit, mm-hmm. I'm assuming that a lot of what you are encouraging them to do is listen and ask questions and understand, because all too often, you know, we can go in with this sense of, he drinks too much, he shouldn't drink so much, you know, why can't he talk to me? Why does he have to go into another room with a bottle? Blah, 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 blah. Right. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And it suddenly becomes, oh, hang on, no one's listening to anyone. No one's actually asking questions. Because when I work, albeit with individuals, the number one place to start is awareness, you know, of understanding why the behavior is there in the first place, not being judgmental about what the behavior is, or even right. necessarily bothering too much about what the behavior is at that point in time, but what role alcohol is playing and what need it's filling and why that isn't coming from somewhere else potentially. Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Because there's a reason why someone's doing what they're doing. And maybe it doesn't work very well for them anymore, but maybe it used to work. Maybe it's the thing they feel like is the only thing that helps them de-stress. Maybe it's the thing they feel like, this is my only me time, or whatever it is. And believe it or not, once you can actually just give space for someone to say that and actually validate what they're saying, it's almost like that is this big block. If you think of it like plumbing, like it's a big clog. And if you just let that come forward, the rest of it comes right after. But I don't like this and this and this about it. But you have to be able to hear that first and have empathy for what they're saying. And then once you can do that, they can come forward with the rest. But what normally happens is if someone's saying, yeah, but it's the only thing that helps me do stress or whatever it is they're saying to you, your immediate response is to want to come back at them, yeah, but blah, 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 you know, and give them 15 reasons why it's not okay, which then again puts them in a position to defend what they're doing, making them further sort of dug into staying in the same old habit. Mm. And it's against our instincts, but once you realize that what they're saying has some validity to it, you can find some point of agreement on it, surely. It doesn't mean 100%. You're saying this is the right way to go about it. You're just saying, yeah, I could see why you'd want to have some drinks at the end of the day. That makes perfect sense to me. If I put myself in your shoes, I could absolutely see that. It's like then they feel safe enough for the rest of it to come forward.
It's so clever. It's so simple, isn't it, when you think about it, really? But it's all the kind of questions that, you know, I always, when I'm working with clients, I'd always say, look, stop trying to stop and start trying to learn about, you know, why you drink, what your triggers are, why you potentially respond the way you do, what needs you might be fulfilling. We can get on how best to, you know, how better to respond at a subsequent time, but let's get to the core understanding of what's driving your behavior. Now, you're having exactly the same conversations, but just on a broader level. And you're saying, and by the way, people, no judgment, please, because the way he or she feels is the way he or she feels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and it's not because of you, and it doesn't have to be responded to with a defensiveness from any other party in the room. It's just the way they feel. So without judgment and without reprimanding. You know, let's just listen, people, to what's going on here and get curious about what's going on. I love that.
Yeah. And empathy, and I know you're a big sort of brain-based person too, Anna. When you respond with empathy, it activates the learning center in someone's brain. So if you don't respond with empathy, then you're going to be activating the emotional center of their brain, which just is bringing defensiveness. And so it's very strategic. And it may feel unfair. And I say that a lot in my YouTube videos. I'm like, listen, there's nothing I'm telling you that's fair as a family member. This isn't fair, but it works. It's not about what's fair. It's about what works. So just do it anyway. Say it this way. Do it this way. It will work. And it does.
Yeah, no, I can see that. So there's obviously a sort of a period of time, a period of your work with people, which is all about surfacing, you know, building trust, building the conversations again, building the connections, creating that sort of safe space. And then obviously the individual, the person who may be drinking too much, has got some issues they need to sort out. And do you then sort of continue to work as a unit on that, or do you tend to sort of shift the onus then onto the individual more?
Well, when people actually come into our practice, we work with family, but we don't work with everyone in the same room. We give everyone their own advocate. We call it lawyering. I'm usually a defense attorney. I'm always a defense attorney. And so my job, I tell my clients, my job is to dig you out of whatever hole you're in. And don't worry, you got a good defense attorney. We're going to get you out of this. And I align with them immediately. What is your main problem here? Is it your spouse is on your case? All right, I got you. I'll go and talk to the family counselor. I'll get them off your case. And I do. And so although we do work with family systems, we don't put everyone in the same room to work on it together. We work on it separately, but simultaneously, if that makes any sense. Or if the person isn't ready to come in, then maybe the person that has the substance issue, we work just with the family to get the person to the point of coming in. And then in that case, then we still work separately but simultaneously.
Yeah. Okay. So would there ever be an element of almost, you know, and I'm going to use this term, but I know even before I say it, it's wrong. I just can't think off the top of my head. Not marriage counseling, but is there ever a situation where the couple might be sat there bashing through their issues together?
Mm-hmm. We do bring everyone in the same room, but we like to have a plan for what are we coming in the same room to talk about, and we bring you in and you have your lawyer present. So you don't feel like you're, particularly for the person who has maybe that's drinking, because they feel like they're in the principal's office, and that's not going to work if they feel ganged up on. And so when we do come in the same room, we come in, it's like all four of us, myself, my client, the family member, their coach, and we hash it out. We try not to let it get into just spiraling into negativity, because the reason we don't put everyone in the same room, there's usually so much hurt feelings and distrust going both ways that either they don't want to argue in front of other people, and so they don't say anything, and then they leave feeling like, well, that was a waste. Or they do say what they're thinking and feeling, and then it turns into a giant argument, and they leave feeling worse than when they came in, and they think, well, that's not helping anything. That's making us worse or whatever. And so that's why we separate it. We have a game plan. A lot of it gets handled behind the scenes between the two coaches or counselors. Negotiate a lot of it, just kind of like lawyering does in mediation. And then we will come in the same room if there's a specific thing we want to address with an agenda and a plan. And you have your person that can kind of have your back so you don't feel under attack.
And is it too simple to, is it an oversimplification to say that the goal is to get to a point where the individual who is drinking is happy to now go on their own drinking journey, not necessarily a sobriety journey, but sort of a recovery or a lessening of their drinking behaviors, fully supported and in full awareness of, you know, the support they have from the rest of the family.
Yes.
That would be the goal.
That's really goal number one, is to bring everything above, I call it above board. and to get us out of this secret keeping power struggle. So goal number one, whatever you're going to drink or not drink or whatever you're going to do, let's bring everything above board. And we have to create safety for that to happen, because the biggest problems in the relationship is the distrust more than anything else. It's the lying and the sneaking and the controlling. And so we try to remove that. That's like first and foremost, goal number one, let's bring everything above board, you know, let's quit the sneaking on both sides.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you know, having seen it so many times myself with individual clients is, you know, so much self-trust has gone as well. At the point when someone's in an addictive relationship with a substance, you know, they're not even necessarily trusting themselves. So I suppose to get to a point where they are trusting themselves again, that they can actually do this, and they are trusting of everyone else's sort of support. That's a huge, I mean, you're absolutely right. That's a sort of baseline, isn't it? That's where we need to get to start with.
Right. Let's quit hiding it. Let's put it in the refrigerator. You know, let's go.
Yeah.
Let's be above board on both sides so that we can get some level of safety back. And then the work can start.
Yeah. Brilliant. I want to make sure we've got time to talk about boundaries, because I've watched quite a lot of your YouTube channels, and you talk about boundaries in a really interesting way, in a very different way, because quite often we will talk about boundaries as walls, you know, and we will say that there's we're winding up the drawbridge, we're putting up boundaries, we're protecting ourselves, etc. And I think one of the things that really, you know, hits home with me is you tend to think of them less as walls and more as kind of bridges, which is an incredibly hopeful and positive way of looking at them. Instead of sort of pushing people away, it's about, you know, trying to create the connections through which we can kind of all come together. Can you explain a little bit about your perspective on that, Amber?
I feel like a lot of people get confused. What they're calling boundaries are really rules that they're setting for the other person. And, you know, there's a lot of pop psychology lately. So people have learned that, like, they'll say, oh, I'm setting this for myself, but they're not really. They're really sort of hiding behind it. They're using good jargon or whatever, but they're setting rules for another person. And then they're punishing another person when that person doesn't follow the rules. And that is the opposite formula as what you want. You really want to set as absolute few rules as possible, because you have to back them up. So, and I've been like that since the beginning. When I run treatment, I'm like, we have one rule, and that's you can't put someone else at risk. Like, that's it. Like, I don't have other rules about language, nothing, because I'm just not going to chase or fight about things. So boundaries really are about what you're going to do and not going to do. Like, for example, a boundary might be, I'm not going to try to get my badge out and secret find all your secret stash and prove you wrong. That's a boundary you can set for yourself. I'm not going to engage in a conversation if you're yelling drunk at me. I'm just going to go read my book, watch TV. I'm going to go do whatever. As opposed to, you can't have more than three. You can't have alcohol in the house. You can't this. You can't. Those are rules.
Yeah. No, massively different. Massively really different.
Different. Right. And the other thing that I would say is, if you're dealing with someone who you think is in denial about the problem, the worst thing you could do is set a rule on it. Because if you set a rule on it, they might follow the rule, and then they're going to think they got this. So don't try to slow it down. That's the worst thing. Like, if you're dealing with someone who has a problem, who doesn't think they have a problem, don't try to put the gates on it.
Yeah, but that's a really refreshing way of looking at it, because effectively what you're saying there is a boundary is, yes, it's there to bring clarity, but it's essentially saying, this is what I can and can't accept. This is how I will or will not respond. Mm-hmm. And as you say, you know, I'm not willing to argue with someone who's been drinking. I'll walk away. We can talk about it tomorrow. That's not cutting the person off.
Right.
That's naming the reality of the situation really, really clearly, so everyone knows where they stand. So it's a clarity setting exercise, as opposed to a, you know, hitting someone over the head with a baton and trying to apply a rule that they never even bought into in the first place.
And you don't necessarily even have to say it to them, because that's the other thing. Mm. We think, if I have a boundary, I need to communicate the boundary. And we think, well, I'm just being fair. But a lot of times when we're doing that, it feels like you're in trouble or like an insult. Like, if you this and I this or whatever, you don't have to say it. Like, you don't have to tell this person everything that you're thinking, because it's just really going to instigate an argument. Like, for example, a common one with dealing with someone is maybe drinking too much is, it's like, don't call me if you've been drinking. Okay. A better rule for that is, I'm not going to answer the phone after 5:30, because I know they've been drinking, but I don't need to say that to them. I just need to not answer. Whereas what most people want to do is they say, don't call me if you've been drinking. And then the person calls, they pick up the phone and they say, I told you not to call when you've been drinking. And then they just keep picking up the phone and saying, I'm like, what is this? Like, what is happening here? That's not boundary. That's setting a rule that someone else isn't following and that you're getting mad about.
And you're not following through on it either.
Right.
You know, yeah, exactly. Right. So, but I guess even when those sort of boundaries aren't spoken, even if they're not the sort of the spoken version of them, over time, it creates a consistency, mm-hmm. which is important. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, you know, the relationship itself, because obviously alcohol can bring a lot of chaos and unpredictability into a relationship, but those sort of boundaries, even as I say, if they're the silent ones, but they are consistently upheld, it brings a level of predictability. It takes the chaos, or it can take the volatility and the chaos out of things. And in a way, even though they're unspoken, the drinker does begin to come to know what to expect.
Yeah, exactly. People only do what works. And so if something they're doing stops working, they'll do something else. I mean, that's just human nature. And so, and you don't even have to like connect the dot necessarily between what you're doing and the drinking. It's actually better if you let the other person connect the dot instead of you connecting the dot for them. Because when you do that, it tends to make them defensive. Just say, I don't know, I'll take your, you know, I answer the phone. I don't answer the phone after this and that because I'm relaxing. Whatever you want to say, you don't even have to explain all of it. And a lot of times I find it's better if you don't.
Yeah, so that was actually going to be one of my next questions, because I was thinking, you know, if people are listening to this today, and, you know, there may well be people listening to this thinking, I want to get in touch with Amber. She sounds like, you know, she's got her head screwed on about these kind of things and she can help. But the reality is as well, there is stuff, particularly with that sort of boundary setting, that people can start to do today, even if a drinker isn't ready, even if, you know, a family unit isn't ready to try and bring that drinker to the conversation. Mm-hmm. If that family member is able to start shifting their own dynamics for the better, putting their own sort of boundaries in place, then an individual shift in dynamics does actually start to shift the dynamic overall. So because I was going to say to you, what's the one small thing that people can start to do today to help shift that dynamic? And it sounds like that boundary setting stuff, you know, knowing what you're willing to accept and not accept and how you will respond is pretty key, actually.
The most important thing is to not play the villain role more than the boundaries. The boundaries is important to protect yourself. And in order to not play the villain, if you're not protecting yourself, you're going to keep falling to the villain role because you're going to get mad. So you do need to protect yourself, mostly so that you don't get yourself in that resentful, angry place. Yeah. You know, like, for example, if you're putting yourself in financial burden for someone else, and you keep doing that, then you're going to be angry. You're going to keep being this villain towards them. You're going to be mad. You're going to be lecturing. You're going to be rule setting and doing all the things because you're not in a financial good place because you're not protecting yourself. So the boundaries are important, but the main thing is to get out of the villain role. And that may not make a person stop drinking immediately, but it will shift the dynamic of the relationship almost immediately. And once that shift happens, it clears the space for the person to start to figure out their own drinking issue.
Okay. So, and just to be clear, when you sort of say take yourself out of that villain role, is that about sort of trying to, you know, as best as you can, stop with the judgment, not putting yourself in a position where you are seen as, you know, the one delivering, the nagging, the sort of, all of that.
Yeah. Like let's say your partner says to you, I'm only going to drink on the weekends. And it's Thursday, and the person goes and gets a drink, and you're going to want to be the one to say, but you said you're only going to drink on the weekends. Don't connect the dot for them. Let them connect their own dot. They will connect the dot, I promise. So you're not the one that tries to be the keeper and the reminder. There are a few things that come to safety that you absolutely have to step in on, particularly when it comes to kids or safety. You know, those are things that you can't let a person figure out or connect their own dot on. Other than that, you want to try to step back and let that person set a boundary for themselves and realize that that person may not stick to their boundary and let them fall, because it's a learning process and you're giving the person space to learn and figure out for themselves.
This is, I suppose, a point where I'm going to have to sort of emphasize that I'm assuming that this is, you know, this is probably a gradual process. It's not something that's going to sort of shift overnight. Cause I can sort of, sit here thinking to myself, you know, the first step, in a way, from what I've taken from what we've talked about, is that long before the individual might come to the table with you to talk about this, you might not be able to control them and get them to the table, but you can change your role in the whole thing. So, you know, drop with the bad guy, as you say, but also just try and shift. You know, you can change your response to what's going on around you. You can put up these boundaries. You can create a sort of a calmer world by just doing those sort of two or three things. Again, you know, that's not going to be perfect. It's not always going to do it. You know, we're all very emotional beings. So it's going to go awry sometimes.
You're going to have relapses too. You're going to have some relapses. That's all right. It's all right.
Yeah.
But it's a learning process for you. That's right. Both sides.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. But that's so interesting though. It is. It's about counterintuitively, because of course, you know, you really are wanting to stop this behavior and stop this now and the mayhem that it might be causing. And, you know, you've got health worries on their behalf. You've got all sorts of things going on. Mm-hmm. You're scared. Mm-hmm. Everything's going on emotionally for you too. But it's about sort of just trying to take the heat out of the moment.
Right. It's similar to, I always say, it's like when you start sliding on ice in the car and they say, don't slam the brakes. That's what I'm telling you. Don't slam the brakes because that's going to surely make you skid off the road. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
against yeah, your sure. instincts, but it works.
Oh my gosh, Amber, I have this sort of feeling, obviously, that it's amazing that you've come on the show, because I'm going to be able to say to people, what is your YouTube channel? And allow people, because I know that it's all clearly sort of broken up into episodes and chunks and conversations, all very clearly labeled. Mm-hmm. Some of them very sort of problem led, you know, what to do if, or what happens when. And so talk to us a little bit about your YouTube channel and what's on there.
Yeah. So the channel is called Put the Shovel Down. And it means you hit your bottom when you put the shovel down. You don't have to keep digging. You can be done whenever you want to be done. And there are videos on the channel from every perspective. And we really do try to look at this thing from multiple perspectives. So whether you're coming because you're trying to help a loved one, whether you're coming because you're trying to figure out where you stand with some of this, you know, whether or not you have a problem, whether or not you want to slow down, you want to stop, whatever, you can find, and I have it all sort of laid out in playlists and topics, so you can kind of, where you can find what fits for you.
There's some brilliant stuff. There's some brilliant stuff on there. So I totally encourage anyone who's listening to this to go and seek out the channel and dip in, because there's so much. You've been doing it a long time, so there's a lot of stuff on there.
There's a lot of stuff. Big
back catalog. So we need to wrap up because of timing and stuff. But I just I know this conversation will have sort of talked to people in a way that perhaps demonstrates that there's a different route. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, a different route to reconnecting when it can feel like, you know, alcohol is just pulling everybody apart and pulling things apart. There's a pretty smart way of reconnecting. And the thing I love about it is it can only end in greater understanding and more empathy. Even if you get to a point where you don't truly get it, everything you find out about, you know, this person, the drinker, and why they do what they do and why they behave, you don't necessarily have to get it, but you can see it. And you can you're at least working with all the facts, as opposed to filling in all those gaps with your own sort of worst fears and assumptions and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think, you know, we talk about how alcohol might create distance, but, you know, with clarity and boundaries and compassion, those distances can be bridged. It's brilliant. Any final advice for people, Amber?
I'll leave you with is that you're not powerless, no matter what side of this you're on. People conquer this issue every single day. Don't listen to those negative statistics that you hear out there. They're not true. I've been doing this a long time, and most people figure this out.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember who said it, but it's one of my favorite quotes. It's like, everything is figure outable.
So that's right.
It genuinely is, you know, but it is, sometimes it's about standing back, isn't it, and looking at it from a different angle. And actually, you know, what do I need right now is probably, you know, greater insight into what's going on.
Right. It's about strategy and understanding. You beat this thing through strategy.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I know, as I say, I know your YouTube channel is full of such strategy. So I'm going to point people that way and wrap up the conversation here with a massive, massive thank you for coming on and spending your time with us. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about The Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's the beliefs, BELIEFS coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.